Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this day before Thanksgiving, the 25th of November, and we wish you all a very happy Thanksgiving as you're preparing the meal for tomorrow. We're going to talk about children this hour of the show, and our guests are the authors of Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. The authors include these topics will get you the inverse power of praise. Sure, he's special, but new research suggests if you tell him that, you'll ruin him. It's a neurobiological fact. What about sleep? This always gets me. It's so hard to get young people to go to sleep and wait until they're 14 or 15 or 16 and they have to start school at a very, very early hour in the morning and they don't get enough sleep. We'll look at racial issues. We'll talk about why children lie, whether or not it's a good idea to find out how smart children are when they're in kindergarten. What about teen rebellion? What about self-control? That's always a big one, how to get your young people in your family or if you're a teacher in your school to get them to be self-motivated. We have two guests with us this hour, and they are the co-authors of this book, Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman. Their articles actually for the New York Times have won the award for outstanding journalism from the Council on Contemporary Families. They've written a series of articles on the science of parenting, and the articles have attracted a great deal of notice. Poe Bronson, prior to collaborating on this book, authored the number one New York Times bestseller, What Should I Do With My Life? And Ashley Merriman's journalism has appeared in the Washington Post and the National Catholic Reporter. We'll welcome phone calls. I'm sure we'll have many as we glide along this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Ashley, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, happy day before Thanksgiving.
You too.
Yeah, Poe, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it, Kat.
Yeah, our great pleasure. I always love Thanksgiving, don't you? So a lot of what we talk about this hour can be fodder, perhaps for the dinner table conversation or maybe after the conversation as children get together with families, et cetera. Your book looks at things that you think are contrary to how we have been parenting. Poe, let's start with you for a moment, and you write about your son and how difficult it was to change the way you praised your son based on the evidence that you saw. What evidence did you see in terms of praise? And Ashley, chime in with this too, the evidence that you've looked at.
This was actually the start of the entire book. This was our first article. It began with Carol Dweck's work on motivation and praise. She did experiments on fifth graders where they were given a series of very short IQ tests, and after the first test, they were praised for how smart they were or praised for how hard they had worked. And the kids who had been praised for how smart they were then became immediately obsessed with how smart they appeared, and they became afraid to take academic challenges, afraid to take harder tests because they didn't want to look like they got any wrong. And this sort of obsession over time through a series of IQ tests made them underperform over time by 30%, while those kids who had been praised for how hard they worked, they just rolled up their sleeves, they were fine getting things wrong, they enjoyed hard tests, and their scores went up by 20%. So within literally an hour, with a single line of praise, she had engineered a 50% swing between the two groups with their performance on these IQ tests. And this piece of research she actually first found and we discussed went on to look at other research on praise, which showed that it should be specific, not general. Kids should be taught how to deal with difficulty, not constantly focus on just how great they are, and that praising them for their intelligence only works, to praise them for the great only works as long as things are really going well. Once they hit failure and difficulty, they don't really know what to do.
Hmm. Ashley, you've worked with a number of children in tutoring and in running programs for children. Does this bear out in the work that you do?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I can see the kids who are overpraised. They fidget. They literally won't solve a math problem until they hear that they're great, and then they do the next one. Kids who are commonly praised are more likely, when you ask them a question, to not answer the question. Instead, they ask another question back. If you say, what's the answer to 2 plus 2, the overpraised kid says, 4? That inflection up is sort of a way of saying, I'm not actually saying the answer. I'm asking you another question, so it's okay if I'm wrong. And I see kids do the eye checking. You know, they're constantly literally looking up while they're doing their work. They want to make sure that I'm paying attention to them and that I'm encouraging them either verbally or in some sort of gesture that they should keep going. The research actually has indicated that college students who are overpraised, you know, for a long time, they have trouble picking a college major because they don't want to commit to something that a year or two down the road they realize they're not that good at.
Kathleen, probably the most interesting thing that put the nail in the coffin for me was is what you mentioned at the lead there, the neurobiological component to this. This is work by Robert Cloninger out of Washington University in St. Louis. And it suggests that that in our brains we have a circuit that sits atop the reward center. And we need to learn to train it up, to make it very active circuit. And to do that, it requires not praising kids all the time, not rewarding them all the time. So they learn to work through periods of difficulty. In a sense, it sort of does an end around in the reward center and says, keep working, even if the rewards aren't here right now. They will be there on the horizon. And that humans and rats and kids can all be sort of trained up to have active circuits or inactive circuits. And constant praise, constant rewarding kids gives them inactive circuitry. And that scared me. So it wasn't just a metaphor to call, say, children praise junkies. It was really a neurobiological element, an anatomical argument.
And yet, the opposite. Let's talk about that for a moment. If you don't get much praise, we all know people who have never received any praise at all, you know, and finally maybe somebody will say, you're really good at this. They say, I am? You know, it's, wait a second, I never thought I was good at anything.
I think that you're right, and those tend to be not today's kids. They tend to be today's grown-ups who had parents who never gave them consideration, who never complimented them, who never said good job, who didn't stroke them. And I think it's for fear of becoming those kinds of parents, it's for fear of being conditional lovers as parents, that we as a generation turned it around and bought into the self-esteem movement and thought, kids don't just need lots of love and encouragement, they need more than that. They need stickers and ribbons and trophies. and they need prizes for cleaning the table, and we need to do anything to protect their esteem, to make them feel good about themselves, and deprive them of any sense of failure for fear it will rattle their confidence so badly they won't take risks down the road.
And is part of the problem here, Ashley, that parents are the ones who need all of this? They need the trophies. They need to make sure that their children are on the top.
Well, Roy Baumeister is a researcher in Florida State, and he did actually think that a lot of the parents, when they're praising their kids, are actually sort of enjoying the praise themselves because it is sort of proof that they're good parents or that they're living through their kids, and they're sort of more fulfilled in that. You know, I was recently talking to a group of parents who had gifted kids, and they were incredibly invested in the idea that their kids were gifted. They wanted to hear that their kids, that label. And I said, well, I'm not saying your kids aren't gifted, but is there a psychological cost to them being told all the time, you have this magical thing, live up to it? And a few of the parents were like, oh, hey, maybe we should think about this. And the other parents were like, no, my kids are gifted, and that's all I need to hear, and how dare you say otherwise. I really think, though, that the main thing, and Poe was talking about, is the shift in terms of attention to what kids are doing or who they are. You know, I don't think any parent would say the right response when a kid throws a ball in the house and he accidentally breaks the base is to say, you bad kid. You know, I mean, maybe if you completely lost it, you would say that, but we wouldn't all go, that was the right response, right? We would say, you did a really bad thing. I told you a dozen times not to play ball in the house, and this is what happens. And we'd move on. If that same kid brings home a vase he made from art class, what's the response? Oh, honey, that's amazing. You're such an artist. You're a genius. Both of those, you bad kid and you wonderful kid, are wild overstatements of the situation. So Carol Dweck's research is really saying, focus on what the kid did. Just like you'd say, don't throw the ball in the house. Wow, Sweeney, looks like you really enjoyed art class today. You use really interesting colors on your vase, and can you tell me about that? And engage them in that process. And when you do that, when they encounter failure, it's not so much an indictment on their human being. It's, oh, I got a problem. How can we work this out?
Is that what you mean when you talk about specific praise, what Ashley was just describing, Poe?
Yes. You know, my daughter is learning to read. She's five. And I've learned not to, my son was doing the same process, is when we first got attuned to the Dweck's research on praise. So now my daughter's come along, and it's very different for me. I'm like, you're going to get into repetition. If you do this a little bit every day, over a few years, you'll be reading just like your brother. And it's not about how great you are, how you're not doing well enough. It's about the specifics, keeping her eyes on the page rather than looking at me, keeping her finger on the page moving along. And for her, it's making the initial consonant vowel sounds that help her sound out the word. And if she does those three specific things, and so I praise her for those specific things because it always attunes her to, she gets a new book and she's scared, I've never seen this book before, how am I going to read it, I don't know any of the words. And she gets kind of nervous, and she just focuses on her strategy, she does fine. So, you know, kids hear so much praise today that quite a bit of science is now saying that they're tuning it all out, that only kids under the age of 7 are taking praise at face value. And there are experiments where kids watch videotapes or reenactments of another student being praised by a teacher, being told by the teacher, you did great, that was fabulous. And the observing student, you know, watching this from videotape or acted out, is asked, well, how well do you think that kid did? Well, you might think the kid would say, well, he did fabulous, he did really great. But no, they assume the kid is doing poorly. They have learned to decipher praise's real meaning, which is that it's kids who are falling behind who seem to get all the praise. Therefore, to be praised all the time is a sign that parents and teachers are worried about you.
It's another layer, isn't it? At what point, I'm interested in what you have to say about our testing of kids, this whole baby Einstein thing that people have, now there are studies showing that it's a lot of hooey. People going into gifted programs, people being segregated in terms of intelligence at very, very young ages.
Ashley, do you want to take this?
Sure. Well, you know, there are preschools that we won't identify because we don't want to encourage them, but they test for admission on IQ for 3-year-olds.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's crazy, and we all admit that's the, you know, aberrational. But almost, you know, Poe and I called every one of the 20 largest school districts in the country, and they're all doing some sort of IQ assessment for giftedness at 5 years old.
Hmm.
I mean, none of nobody
years
waits.
Old, yeah. Mm. And it's not that much better than 3 years old.
Right, and we actually wonder.
That is when kindergarten starts, so these programs feel like we have to do it, kindergarten starting. But the accuracy rate, if you test kids for their IQ in kindergarten, the thing is their brains just aren't formed yet. The mechanisms of intelligence aren't anatomically there in their brain yet. It's sort of like an engine half built. And you just don't know which kids will really prove to be smart or not. So, you know, regardless of whether you agree with gifted programs or not, and I don't really have a problem with the existence of gifted programs whatsoever, but it's about putting the right kids into the program. And the accuracy rate, and this is the people who write the tests themselves have told us this. They get if you test them in kindergarten, and then you're looking, measure them again in third grade, those kindergarten tests picked the wrong kids astonishing,
really?
73% of
really?
The time.
Oh, my gosh.
Almost 3/4 of kids are wrongly identified by using the test so early in their life. If we just waited a few years, the test would be, no test is going to be perfect. And there's nothing wrong with the test. It's not like there's a better test. It's simply the kids are too young. And if we just waited a few years, you know, waited till third grade, you get at least a doubling, of the accuracy of predicting which kids really will be smart.
What about
if you looked at the scores of the third graders and you asked how did they do in kindergarten, a third of them would have in kindergarten scored below average.
That's quite remarkable.
And it's a third grade, really, that, I mean, there's neurological points that are changing, but that's also a point when curriculum changes, right? In kindergarten, first, second grade, it's about learning how to say letters, learning sounds, numbers. But third grade's when you really start asking comprehension questions, application of math ideas, and that's really when you start seeing that split in terms of when kids really actually have a gift. When you test kids earlier, what you end up really finding is socioeconomic differences. You know, a more affluent, you know, professional mom who's taken her baby to art museums and talked all the time and had a lot of enrichment in preschool and that kind of thing, that kid tests better.
Right. What about discovering aptitudes, though? Do you believe that at the age of 3 or at the age of 5, you can determine whether or not a child is musical, whether or not he or she has an aptitude for writing or for artwork?
Well, you know, there are studies comparing siblings, you know, when the parents say, oh, my kids are as different as night and day, and they look at those sort of aptitude signals, and they find that they really aren't as different as night and day. But parents feed off of sort of subtle cues, and then it becomes a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy that you're the smart kid, you're the pretty one, or you're the athletic one. So, I mean, and what Poe and I are talking about, we're not talking about true prodigies like Midori, the 3-year-old who picks up a violin and is ready to go on concert tours. We're talking about the fact that 90% or the average IQ of a college student is 120. And that's about what schools are looking for when they're identifying giftedness. So I think there are earlier indicators of interest, but how you respond to them, I think, is more determinative of that early aptitude than the actual presence that this is the one thing they're good at. We just really don't know.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and there's much more in the book. Our guests are Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman. The book is Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. The area that has received a whole lot of attention, as you can tell, is praise. But there are also chapters on racial issues, which I'm particularly interested in talking to them about that. And there are issues, can self-control be taught, the science of teen rebellion, the sibling effect, why kids lie, and the sleep issue. I want to talk about the sleep issue. I think they're really onto something here, and why high schools start at 7:30 in the morning is beyond me. More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to phone calls now for Poe and Ashley, starting with Brian from Lake Villa. Hi, Brian.
Hi.
Hi.
I had two things. First one, when I was very young, and I'm talking back in the 60s, I was tested probably 3 times for IQ. Mm-hmm. I never got any feedback. It was strictly used by the people who were making decisions about what I was doing. So I didn't know. I didn't get praised or anything for any of that. The other comment is I can't identify the ages at which I was tested, but I dropped 40 points between my first test and my second test, and then went back up 20 points on the third test.
The IQ test you're talking about?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that was very age-dependent, because I'm pretty sure the first one was, you know, probably first or second grade.
All this sounds very consistent with what we've heard, Brian. In the old days, people, the IQ tests are considered very valid indicators of how a child is doing right now.
Right.
So if you're not making some long-term structural decision over a kid's lives, you're just trying to say, well, what teacher might be best for them? Or what curriculum should I put in front of this child? Or which group in the classroom should he sit with? They're valid, very valid for that. But if you're saying, I'm going to take him out of this school and for the next 9 years put him in this other school,
right.
your own scoring shows you just how crazy that can be. Two-thirds.
What about that is the socialization aspect. If you take all the bright kids and stick them with all the bright kids, and they don't get associated with the other children, then they don't understand them.
You know, this has always been a concern with gifted education, and most gifted education programs have dealt with that. So what they tend to do is they put a gifted track inside a building with with other programs. And in some places, such as in New York City, they have sort of a super gifted and a regular gifted and the regular kids all in the same building, and it's just about different classrooms. So they get socialization time, and I think the gifted education is aware of this and is trying to deal with it.
That's good. But
the variability of intelligence in the young ages is quite clear. Two-thirds of all kids will have swings of plus or minus 15 points, and most of them will have several swings of that magnitude. And 30% of all kids will have swings of more than 30 points, like you did. And this isn't uncommon, and that's why it's a risky proposition to treat a single IQ test as a valid indicator of exactly how a kid is doing. What you said, Brian, was you were tested three times. That's good. That means they're checking on you to make sure. In modern gifted education, people are so afraid of gifted kids being vulnerable, psychologically vulnerable, that they test them once, usually to get into the program. But in none of the top 20 school districts in the country do they ever test them again to make sure they still deserve to be there.
Yeah.
Only a few districts, like Seattle, makes you about every 3 years test again. You know, you don't have to score quite as high as you did the first time, but make sure you still belong in the program.
Hmm, interesting. Thanks, Brian. You know, I have no idea. I've never known what my IQ is. I don't remember ever taking an IQ test in my life, although I guess the SATs were some indication of, you know, where you were strong and where you weren't. And the second category was math. But I got along just fine. I just worked kind of hard on everything that I did. But do you guys remember taking IQ tests?
I never took one.
You never did
in my
either.
Life, yeah.
No. And what about you, Ashley?
While we were writing this book that I had been tested for giftedness when I was in kindergarten, and I never knew what it was. I actually broke my front tooth when I was in kindergarten. And the person giving me the test was a speech therapist, so I thought it was about whether or not I could talk.
Oh.
I had a lisp. But I remember quite vividly on a couple different occasions having to put blocks together and how you match blocks and stack blocks as part of a kid's IQ test. And they made me do the block thing like two or three times and then just sort of stopped. And what I realized is they decided I wasn't gifted. The truth was, whether or not I was a gifted, I was a klutz. And I couldn't, and if you can't put the blocks together within a quarter of an inch correctly, that's considered not gifted.
Oh, my gosh.
So
how are you doing with all...
I remember being really upset and not wanting to play with the blocks anymore.
Oh, Ashley.
Really hard.
Oh.
And I think that was one of the things, you know, from Poe and I, it wasn't, you know, the kids were being encouraged, that's great, but there are kids who at 5 and 3 who are being told, you're not gifted. And their parents are being told, your kid's not gifted. And are mentally they sort of going, okay, well, then I don't really need to plan for Harvard because they're not going there. Maybe they'll get into a state school.
Right.
And what kind of, you know, attitude is that having just as much as for the kids who did get into the program?
Truth is, one-third of gifted kids in third grade scored below average at kindergarten.
One-third.
One-third. We're not talking about just a few late bloomers. We're talking one-third of the smartest third graders in the country back in kindergarten didn't look gifted.
Right.
So, again, I have no problem with gifted programs. I think that they're very conscientious about the needs of the kids. It's about putting the right kids in the program.
Right. Ashley, I want you to be able to play with blocks tomorrow on Thanksgiving. You can have a fun day.
Right?
Let's go to more phone calls. Louise from Hillsboro is next. Hi, Louise.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
It's not that I disagree with the idea that there's this over-insincere praising, but why is it, I mean, my experience has been that you take children in preschool and you say, who can sing? Who can draw? Who can dance? And they all raise their hands, and by third grade, nobody raises their hands. And I don't know, it seems like a very sad event to me.
I completely agree, and this is very much the impulse behind wanting to praise them, telling them all the time, you're good at these things, you're good at these things, because kids, they start to hit elementary school, and they start to compare themselves to the best kid in class, and they start to develop an identity they're not as good. But the question is, how do you deal with that? The assumption that all you have to do to deal with that is tell kids, you're great, this is how you dance. My kids go to a theater school where they take dance every day. They learn to dance. And you know, my son is an example of, he didn't think he could dance in kindergarten, he didn't think he could dance in first grade, but he kept taking class. And by third grade, he's like, I'm a great dancer. So if you want your kids to sing and draw and dance, teach them to sing and draw and dance. Don't just try to fool them into thinking they know how to sing and draw and dance, because there is, in third grade, good. There are these are art forms that can be taught, and all kids can learn them. But instead, what we try to do is really trick their perception rather than give them the skills to succeed.
And never underestimate the importance of dancing in life. It's important. I think it is.
My son completely agrees with you, as does my daughter. But that came to her quite easily. Not as easy to my son.
Yeah. Thanks, Louise, very much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. And our guests are the authors of Nurture Shock, Pope Bronson and Ashley Merriman, New Thinking About Children. Why in the world do adolescents start, and my son's school is the same way here, that they were doing 8:30 in the morning, and then because of bus schedules and money, et cetera, they're back to 7:30. Why in the world do you start high school at 7:30 in the morning?
He's lucky. I know schools that start at 7:05 and 7. How's that for awful? You know, it's money. They realized that if they needed to get kids in high school and school all at the same, in elementary school all at 8 o'clock at the same time, they needed twice as many buses. But if they did half of the kids at 7 and half of the kids at 8, then they could just cut down the bus fleet. The same drivers pick up all of the kids. And so they've moved start times about an hour. And that is one of the big reasons that, actually, not just in the United States, but around the world, kids are getting an hour less sleep now than they did 30 years ago. Even kindergartners get a half an hour less sleep.
And what's the effect of that, Paul?
It has dramatic effects that are cognitive, that relate to childhood obesity, and that relate to emotional regulation, ADHD. Let me just mention the cognitive for a moment. What is sleep? Sleep, we spend a third of our lives doing it, and most of us don't know. But what's going, we've all heard that there's phases of sleep. We've all heard that there's lobes of the brain. The different phases of the sleep and lobes of the brain are used to rewrite short-term memory into long-term memory. So everything your kid learns in school one day, while they're sleeping that night, is sort of recoded so it's accessible down the road on the day they take the test, like the SAT test. And as a result, when kids don't get enough sleep, it might as well have not even gone to class that day because it's not getting recoded in their memory. So the result is, in high school students, on average, and this is data out of Minnesota and Rhode Island, but it's well expected to replicate everywhere, which is that A students average about 15 more minutes sleep than B students, who average about 15
really?
More minutes sleep than C students.
Interesting.
Yeah, on average. Now, every kid's a little different there. So that's not, you can just get 15 more minutes sleep to improve your grades, but there really is an important connection between the two. Another study showed that with sixth graders, showed that they just get a half hour less sleep for three nights. They were testing like fourth graders. And it really is affecting the kids' scores. In Minnesota, a very large school district there got rid of the whole two single fleet and went back to a double fleet of buses and started school back at the same hour of 8:40 in the morning, an hour later, and the kids did get more sleep. And in the 3 years after, the school's best and brightest, their SAT scores, went up 212 points.
My goodness. Isn't that amazing? Well, I also think there's a health issue involved with this. You just can't. You become, I think, susceptible, you lower your immune system if you're getting 6 hours of sleep a night when you're that age.
Well, actually, one of the most things that stunned Poe and I is the relationship between kids' sleep and obesity.
Right.
Now, when you and I were growing up, we heard about juvenile diabetes, right? You don't hear that anymore. You just hear type 1 and type 2, and that's because kids get both. Well, a number of researchers are finding that sleep deprivation, and we're talking for kids, sleep shortening, actually predicts obesity. Preschoolers who fall below 10 hours of sleep a night have a 300% higher rate of obesity. for adolescents, for every hour that they don't get of sleep that they're supposed to, their likelihood of becoming obese increases by 80%.
And that seems counterintuitive. So tell me why that's the case.
Well, for one reason, the sleep regulates about at least four, maybe seven different hormones that all have to do with metabolism. The leptin, ghrelin, human growth hormone, all tell the body when to wake up, how much to eat when you do wake up, and now, hey, I'm full. All of those hormones become dysregulated because they're based in sleep. In fact, when we do adult sleep deprivation experiments, we found that sleep loss is the equivalent of a 900-calorie starvation diet. Your brain thinks you're starving for energy because you're sleep-deprived. Even if you don't change anything in your diet, your body says, I need pizza, I need bread, I need carbohydrates, and it keeps adding. I mean, I think that the college freshman 20, which is supposedly pizza and beer, is actually a lot of all-nighters and sleep deprivation. It's also, you're tired when you're awake.
Right.
So you have less energy. You actually do less things when you're sleep deprived. So the energy in the food that you had, your burn off is lower. So it's a cyclical process where the sleeper you are, the hormones are dysregulated, and then that makes you less active and eat it more, and it just keeps going into a spiral.
Jan from Northern Wisconsin, hi.
Hi. I want to talk about something a little bit different. I'm sorry you're in the sleep thing now, but I want to talk about the lack of responsibility in nurturing in the way of how people treat their kids emotionally. I'm going to just give an example. You know, I've been a teacher for many years, and I've seen people in situations say, Mommy wants you to stop kicking that person. That makes Mommy sad when I see you kicking that person. And, you know, I've also seen, like, a guidance counselor say to kids, you know, I'm seeing that you must feel really bad today because you just hit that person. And, you know, what's going on with you? And as a teacher, I really would say things like, stop. Don't kick that person. Or, you know, I mean, you deal directly with the behavior and put the onus back on the person who does it. But I see a lot of parents and teachers, and I don't know if it fits into your book, but nurturing in a way that helps the child evade responsibility for their actions.
Oh, it fits into their book. They deal with a whole chapter of siblings hitting each other. Poe?
Yeah, well, what Jan's talking about here is a body of work that really has to do with forms of discipline and whether parents are using psychological guilt and sort of psychological manipulation. And it's very interesting. Jan, it has been assumed that this was bad. And when all the studies on children in America found that most parents did not do this, but some did, and when they did it, messed the kids up. Here's the big catch. All the work in child development has exploded and been replicated all around the world. And when this type of research was looked at cross-culturally, a good example might be, say, in China. Actually, in China, a lot of sort of psychological guilt is the norm. And when things seem to be the norm, they tend not to mess kids up in the same way. In fact, other forms of discipline seem to be actually mess kids up. Kids, when they're disciplined, need to feel like what's happening, the way they're being treated by their parents, is normal, the way other kids are getting treated as well. And that seems to protect them in some way. So certainly in your classroom, in the culture there in Wisconsin, most parents are just saying stop or don't do that or don't throw a football in the house, and some are trying to make the kid feel guilty. And in that kind of environment, probably not the best for the kids. But you can't just generalize that to the whole world. It's kind of interesting.
Mm. Thanks, Jan, for the call. Bruce from Milwaukee. Hi.
Oh, this goes back to an earlier topic about IQ. I actually saw my IQs, and I saw that they were changed from 130 to 120. And I grew up in a school system where they did a lot of testing. We never knew what it was for. But we were segregated in, I think, seventh grade into the brightest, the next bunch, the next, you know, we were tiered. And all the kids knew who what the smart class was and what was dumb class was. We all knew what was going on. And I was in the second tier, and then they moved me to the top tier. And it was very difficult for me to make that transition because I had been getting A pluses in the second tier, and then I moved to this top tier, and I was getting, like, you know, Bs. And it was very disturbing and to be flipped around in this system based on IQ scores. And then, of course, the ultimate was when my father, 60 years later, tells everybody what our IQs are, and my sister, who ran into the family car into the telephone pole, had 142. So she's not so smart. But when I was in a middle school, everyone kind of pegged everybody else by what class they were in based on this IQ ranking system the school system used.
Hmm. Do you want to take that, Poe? Thanks, Bruce, for your call.
Well, certainly the entire educational system has looked at tracking and said, you know, we're not so sure this is best for kids. We want to teach kids at the level of their ability because they will learn most if the curriculum is focused on what they should be learning now. And some kids might be way ahead and some kids way behind. And if you just give them all the same curriculum, it doesn't work. But there's a trade-off, which is all these other issues, which is about how they feel pegged and tracked and identified, and they start to invest in their identity of who they are, and they feel that these things aren't changeable, aren't malleable. And I think broadly, the education system is sensitive to this, but hasn't, you know, found quite the right answer. And in this day and age, you know, tracking is sort of socially unacceptable, especially because it leads to often very different ethnicities being in different classes, and there's cultural problems with curriculum. So there's the right answer in the science right now.
We're going to take more phone calls in a moment. I'd like to talk a little bit about issues of race, which is an interesting part of this book. And we welcome more phone calls for Ashley and Poe, the authors of Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman are our guests. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we'll be more with you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Scott from Duluth. Hi.
Hi, I just wanted to reinforce the point you made earlier about telling kids they're good at things. There's just three very distinct moments in my childhood where someone told me I was good at something, and I just totally believed it. And, you know, they might not have even really meant it, but it just, you know, since I believed it, I kind of went in those directions. So I try to do that with young kids now.
So what did they tell you?
Well, one was I was in a play and someone told me I was a good dancer. And someone told me I was really good at giving massages, so I've done that. I should have said I was a good investment banker.
It's funny. Poe, you want to take this?
Well, you know, when Scott was growing up, he said there were three things that he distinctly remembers. Now, good. Now, if probably it was sincere. He probably did give a good massage. He probably was a good dancer. And that's why back then people thought, I'm going to single you out and call attention to that. And so the praise was sincere. It was genuine. It was an honest compliment. And Scott could feel that. He felt, he believed it, not just because he heard it, but it, today's kids get told they're good at things three times every hour, three times every 10 minutes. They hear it so much that they can't understand the difference. As I mentioned earlier, my kids go to a theater school, and it's a pretty tough school, and the choir director is in the Sinfonietta, and the voice director is in the opera. So they've had to work with the kids and say, look, you're going to give this big performance. All these parents are going to compliment you. Everybody's going to tell you you're good, you know. Let's focus on what we're doing here. Let's focus on our standard. And if you want to know if you really did well, they tell the kids this. And I don't know if it's right, but they say, if other parents say you did really good, but your own parents, of course, they're always going to say it's good. They're having to give kids skills to filter out
predictable, insincere praise to find out if they really are good at something or not. I wish the kids heard, you know, occasionally, when they really did something well, they heard it. But that's not the case. They hear it no matter how well they're doing, that they're doing great.
So that's really the problem here. It's hearing it way too much, because I think it's kind of sweet that Scott remembers, and I remember that in my life too. People didn't praise me all the time, but some people would say something that you didn't realize what your talent was. Oh, I'm a good dancer. I mean, I think that's kind of sweet that Scott remembers that. He doesn't remember
right.
tons of people saying that, but he remembers being told he's a good dancer.
Exactly.
That's nice.
Exactly.
Isn't it?
I think the real problem is that, especially when kids become addicted to this sort of positive feedback.
Well, sure.
They become extremely risk averse. So it's not that if someone said, hey, honey, you're a good dancer, and they kept dancing, that's a great story. We want to hear that. But I wonder if that kid says, well, you didn't say that about my soccer playing, so I shouldn't play. Or, you know, are they ruling things out? Are they losing opportunities because they didn't get that praise? And they're so used to hearing that praise that the fact that they didn't gets much scarier. And we want kids to try new things, and mistakes are okay.
Yeah. Let's talk about race for just a moment before we go back to phone calls, because I'm not sure I fully understand your chapter on race, and I'm a big believer in desegregated schools, and I think that maybe this is challenging to my way of thinking about schooling. Why white parents don't talk about race? Does teaching children about race and skin color make them better or worse? Poe?
You and I are both big believers in desegregated schools as well, Kathleen. And we both, Ashley in San Diego, where she grew up, myself in Seattle, where I grew up, attended desegregated schools, have always believed in them and still do. The chapter calls attention to the concern that we send children to desegregated schools, but once they get into those schools, self-segregation occurs. Kids on their own tend to create to some extent, somewhat of a mixed culture and somewhat of a culture that's segregated by race, where kids come to school and maybe they themselves have cross-racial friends, but still feel like, oh, I can't go over by those lockers because of my skin color, or I'm not supposed to sit there at the lunch in the lunchroom or at that lunch table because of my skin color. Out on the playground, this isn't where I'm supposed to go because of my skin color, and that they're drawing conclusions from that. And our chapter does call attention to that. Not to criticize desegregated schools, but to help call attention to self-segregation that's going on. And there are things that we can do, things that we can do that involve extracurricular programs, things that we can do that focus on the popular kids as a way of dealing with this. But fundamentally, it comes back to parenting and comes back to what goes on in the home in children's early life. And in typical American homes, 75% of white parents never, almost never, talk about race with their young children, their children who are kindergarten and younger. But for those people of color, 75% of them do talk about race and skin color. And it seems that talking about race and skin color and preaching tolerance from a very young age is helpful. It's very scary to do this because we think, well, you can't call attention to race with a four-year-old and then say, but race doesn't matter. You know, you're trying to preach tolerance, and then, but why even give them names if it does this? But our unwillingness to talk about race, our silence about race, leads to findings such as this work by Phyllis Katz at the University of Colorado. Three-year-olds are given a deck of cards, and on each card there's a kid and a face, and the kids are asked, pick out ones that you think would likely be your friends. And 86% of white kids pick only other white kids as their potential friends. And these are kids whose parents would swear to you, my kid doesn't even see race. He doesn't even notice race. We've never talked about race. At 4 years old and 5 years old, you hand the kids the same deck of cards, and you ask them just to sort it into two piles any way you want. And 16% of kids might just do every other card goes into a different pile. And another 16% of kids would say, well, the boy's in this pile and the girl's in this pile. But 68% of white kids will use race to sort the deck into two piles without any prompting or any mentioning of race. So we think kids aren't seeing it, but they are seeing it, and because we don't talk about it, We're teaching them that it's taboo and that we're scared of this topic, and it's not what's best for kids.
Huh. So what do you think we ought to do?
Well, it's just starting when they're very young. It's talking about, well, this, look in this children's book. Look, this child has brown skin. This child has pinkish, whitish skin. And they're friends. And as they get older, you make it clear, we never pick friends because of their skin color. And you just say very, very, the real model here, Kathleen, ought to be how we talk about gender. As parents, we have no problem when our daughters are two and our sons are three to say things like, you know, girls can be doctors. Girls can do anything. There's nothing boys can do that girls can't do, too. Girls can be race car drivers. And we feel comfortable making these kind of plain statements to make sure that kids don't come to wrong conclusions about gender. And that's really the same simple form ought to be what we do about race and skin color.
Mm-hmm. But did you also look at, and maybe my experience with this is just different. I don't know, because we have three boys who have gone through public schools and schools where probably they were the minority as white kids, and their friends are really mixed. It's just, I mean, it's this wonderful, and it's such a priority in the family that it has governed where we live and all of that. It's very important, and it's interesting to me that we have had those conversations in terms of, you know, when Barack Obama ran for president, but that there's a, it's just sort of a matter-of-fact thing. We don't talk about race. We do talk about race. But just as a matter of being in desegregated schools all their lives, that I really do think they're colorblind kids. You know, that they – I don't know if that's – I don't know what that is. You know, so I read that chapter and I thought, wait a second, I don't see this. And maybe it's just our family might be different in this regard or what. I'm not sure. That if we all live in the same neighborhoods, is this naive, do you think, Ashley, that, you know, there's a way for us to become colorblind?
With the research. One is that when there's low diversity, we do see cross-racial friendships. You know, if there's only four or five kids of one particular, you know, racial group in a school, then there's probably going to be a lot of cross-racial friendship because those kids don't really have any other option.
Uh-huh.
So it encourages them. When you start seeing more racial self-segregation of the kids is the more diverse the campus gets because now kids have the option. And in fact, we've actually, like, the theory, I mean, there's some theories out there that popular kids are doing cross-racial friendships because they sort of have the social capital that they can do something other kids wouldn't. But when we look at who has cross-racial friendships in these huge schools where there are, you know, 30% African-American, 30% Latino, 30% white, 10% Asian, when you really have that huge desegregation,
right,
that the kids who have cross-racial friendships actually tend to be the social outcasts. They're the kids who can't have friends in that group that they're supposed to be doing well in. And they look for the other kids who are social outcasts. So you find that the cross-racial friendships end up with the kids who don't really feel like they fit in. And that doesn't encourage more cross-racial friendships because the kids who are, you know, in their racial group, who are the popular kids, look at the kids with cross-race friends and go, those are the losers. I don't want to be like that. To change the to change the sort of social construct of the kids, you do need those popular kids to be crossing racial lines.
Hmm.
The other thing that you said was really important is about neighborhood. Most times when schools are desegregated, that there involves busing or something like that,
right,
and the kids aren't actually living next to each other, and the friends that they have in the neighborhood are the ones that they have at school. You know, they play with each other after school, they're on the same bus, then they go to school. So there's a connection there. And most of the time, that really falls along racial lines. So, again, that's another reason why it may have been easier for your family, because you were living in the same neighborhood as these kids, and they felt a bond that went beyond the walls of the school. If you just throw them into the school between 8 and 4 and think that they're all going to cross racial lines and it's going to be a big, you know, High School Musical scene,
right,
we're not finding that happening.
Yeah, it's a very interesting chapter. I want to do another program on that. I find it Very compelling. Well, darn, we can't go on because we don't have any more time. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. Really
interesting. Very interesting book. Our thanks to Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman. Their book is Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. We had so many areas that we could have gone a full hour on any one of the areas that we were discussing, but there are areas we didn't even begin to discuss that are in the book as well. It has just been published by 12, and we thank Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. I will not be with you on Thanksgiving. I have to make Aunt Margaret's 24-hour salad and cook a turkey and be with family for my favorite holiday, and I know that it is for many of you as well. A lot of people say, I love Thanksgiving. It doesn't have the stress, although it does if you're cooking a lot. It does have that stress, but it's just nice to get together with family. And I guess a lot of the guys will watch a lot of football, but just get together and have a good time. Enjoy each other. So I'll be with you again on Monday when we'll have all things political for our 9 o'clock hour. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving. And I'm thankful to be here and thankful to have you as an audience. You're a big part of my life. Thanks to all of you. News ahead.